Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an overview of last week's testimony in the House impeachment inquiry and focus on the broader impact of Trump's dealings with Ukraine, all of which were in service of Vladimir Putin's agenda to weaken Ukraine economically and stymie its transition to democracy and the rule of law. Malcolm Nance, a career counterterrorism and intelligence officer with over 33 years in special operations, homeland security, and intelligence operations combating terrorism, joins us to discuss his latest book, Just Out, The Plot to Betray America, How Team Trump Embraced Our Enemies, Compromised Our Society, Our Security, and How We Can Fix It. With Ronald Reagan turning over in his grave since for decades the GOP accused the Democrats of being soft on communism, and now Trump's Republican Party is being soft on Vladimir Putin, we will discuss Trump's deep financial ties to Russia through his family's investments, including those of Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, and Jared Kushner. And we'll also look into the corrupt behavior of his other double-crossing pro-Moscow associates, Paul Manafort, Rudy Giuliani, Roger Stone, and a supporting cast of bagmen and grifters. In untangling the spider web of personal and financial relationships linking the White House to the Kremlin, we'll examine how we can free ourselves from the constricting clutches of our foreign adversaries and work to rebuild our fractured nation. Then, following Attorney General William Barr's outrageous and injudicious speech before the Federalist Society in Washington on Friday, in which he espoused the ultra-conservative views of the secretive Catholic cult Opus Dei, we will look into the need to remove the head of the Justice Department, who is on a crusade to tear down the U.S. Constitution's wall between church and state. Philip Sheehan, a former reporter for the New York Times for more than 20 years who covered the Pentagon and the Justice Department and has an article at The Guardian, A Threat to Democracy, William Barr's Speech on Religious Freedom Alarms Liberal Catholics, joins us. We'll discuss Barr's twisted belief that radical secularists on the left are hamstringing the most power-hungry president in our history, who is recklessly wielding presidential authority, while, contrary to Barr's claim, the Democrats are stymieing his appointments, stacking the federal courts with federal society judges, with more seated so far than his three predecessors, all of whom served for two terms. Then finally, we'll go to Iowa and speak with David Redlawsk, a visiting professor at the University of Iowa and co-author of Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. He joins us to analyze the surge of Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who is now ahead of the crowded field of Democratic presidential hopefuls in polls in Iowa, which holds the first presidential primary election in less than 3 months. And joining us now is Malcolm Nance, a career counterterrorism and intelligence officer with the United States Government Special Operations, Homeland Security and Intelligence Agency, who has over 33 years of experience in combating radical extremism. He's the author of The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. And his latest book, just out, is The Plot to Betray America, How Team Trump Embraced Our Enemies, Compromised Our Security, and How We Can Fix It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Malcolm Nance.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Malcolm. And do you agree that the real subtext to these hearings we heard last week, and we'll hear more of them, because on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, is missed in effect, or you know, with all the process reporting that goes on the daily basis, do you think the public's getting the overall view that almost everything that we're talking about and that the testimony was about last week and will be about this week is how essentially Trump has been helping Putin undermine this frail democracy in next door, who, incidentally, Russian troops are attacking on its eastern front, and they've already seized Crimea, a big chunk of Ukraine's territory?
I think that's right. I think that subtext is starting to come out, principally because you have career State Department diplomats who have been in almost lockstep putting out the message that even though that this matter was about Ukraine, was about working with the current Ukrainian government, the reason that we were sending weapons to Ukraine, the Javelin missiles, why Congress allocated this, was because Ukraine was locked in a deadly war. It's an asymmetric war, which means that Russia is attacking using surrogates, insurgents in the Donbass region, But Russia in 2014 just seized an entire section of Ukraine, Crimea. So by putting this out, it is very clear that Donald Trump was doing this for two reasons. One, his own personal benefit. And, you know, let me use a phrase that the Russians love to use when they're trying to change perceptions in the United States. They did it through a way Trump needs to be seen through what we call meta-narrative framing. That is a very simplistic term which describes how you want to shape the conversation of your opponent. In this case, Donald Trump went to the Ukraine in order to cheat in the 2020 election. That's all of this is about. He went there. He had Rudy Giuliani working it for over a year and a half. He had other associates, including a complete under the table, not back channel, under the table, secret line of communication between people who had nothing to do with the diplomatic corps and who were really there as Trump's henchmen. So all of these activities to get Zelensky to come onto CNN and make a statement that he was investigating Joe Biden was designed to cheat the 2020 election. The other half of this, as we're now finding out, as people constantly mention the name Russia, is the American public are learning that Ukraine was in essentially an existential, you know, war that it, for the, you know, for what Ukraine is going to be composed of. And Moscow is in war with them, which is why they needed these weapon systems. Why Zelensky, knowing that the Javelin missile is a real tank buster, it would stop any Russian advances into that country. Zelensky was ready to do and say anything to get that really decisive weapon into his hands. And Donald Trump blackmailed and extorted him. But he blackmailed and extorted him for Vladimir Putin. And now as we finally see the story play out, this whole story that was in Donald Trump's mind of Hillary Clinton supposedly working with Ukraine to, you know, to hack the DNC servers was actually created by Konstantin Kalimnik, the character who was at the Donald Trump Jr. meeting in Trump Towers, the character who Paul Manafort gave polling information to, who is the FBI assesses is a Russian military intelligence cutout or a former Russian military intelligence officer who still maintains contacts with the Kremlin, and that Donald Trump bought this Vladimir Putin Russian line lock, stock, and barrel. And that was another reason that he was pressuring Zelensky, because he believed a Russian spy's framing of the 2020 election, which in his mind would make him and Russia completely innocent of anything that happened. It's absolutely mind-boggling how, one, stupid it is, and two, how vapid he must think the rest of the world is. But that's Donald Trump.
And, of course, Manafort and Kalimnik exchanged vital polling information, which the Russians were able to use to micro-target through Facebook during the elections. And, of course, that meeting took place in the cigar bar in Jared Kushner's building at 666 Fifth Avenue. But how do you – you mentioned shaping the narrative. How do you shape the narrative of the enemies of truth at Fox News? And how do you get the 40% in Trump's base, Malcolm, to read your new book?
Well, you can't. I'm just sorry. The 40% of the country now who are enthralled with Donald Trump, which means they also believe his worldview. And this is a worldview, by the way, which was crafted by Moscow, by, you know, when Trump was there for Miss Universe and Trump being offered Trump Tower 2.0 and Trump taking Russian money. He views Russia as a friend and an ally who hand him money. So that's his worldview. So it can never be wrong. He can never insult Vladimir Putin, who is technically his bookie. And you never insult your bookie when you owe money, right? But that 40% of this country has now been told Russia is our friend. They are not malicious. Trump gives away U.S. national security to them, and in not even in direct ways like he did in Syria, where they just went into our camps and raised their flag, in indirect ways, like Michael Flynn's secret plan, which I wrote about in this book, to work with Saudi Arabia to buy 40 Russian light water nuclear reactors for power. Because the Saudis don't want to burn oil. The Saudis want to sell every drop of oil to us. So they want to put power plants in that country. No one thought this would go through because it would require United States government approval for Saudi Arabia to get Russian nuclear power plants that was being negotiated by the former head of Defense Intelligence Agency. Donald Trump's Department of Energy, run by Rick Perry, is authorizing that transfer of power and technology and giving those permissions. They have just utterly been taken over by Russia, and I've actually called this maybe one of the greatest intelligence operations in history, because they have bought not just the government, they have used their information warfare strategies and techniques to change the mind of 40% of the American public to the point where I wouldn't be surprised if they view Vladimir Putin as a savior.
And again, I'm speaking with Malcolm Nance, a career counterterrorism and intelligence officer with the United States Government Special Operations, Homeland Security and Intelligence Agencies, who has over 33 years of experience in combating radical extremism. He's the author of The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. And his latest book just out is The Plot to Betray America, How Team Trump Embraced Our Enemies, Compromised Our Security, and How We Can Fix It. And it's clear that Donald Trump is terrified of his tax returns being made public, and we'll see whether this Supreme Court is partisan, as we suspect it is, because the case that's now been handed to them by the appeals court is so clearly unbreakable in a way in terms of the law. But then, if they vote in Trump's favor, then they truly are showing their partisan stripes. But the other thing that I understand that terrifies Trump is the counterintelligence file on him compiled by the FBI and the CIA and the National Security Agency over the many decades of his relationships with the Russians. I understand that towards the end of the Obama administration, that file was duplicated and spread amongst the government in order to stop Trump from destroying it, which he's been trying to do. If you look at the record, it's pretty clear that the people that Trump attacks most are people who have read the counterintelligence file. That is Comey, Clapper, Brennan. And Trump has absolutely purged the counterintelligence officers in the FBI, McCabe, Strzok, Lisa Page, and Bruce Orr. So he is on a war against the people in our government with the institutional knowledge about Russia and Russia's malign activity. My understanding is it's all about, in other words, let me ask you this bluntly, Malcolm Nance. Why the hell can't the public in this country get access to the counterintelligence file on Donald Trump?
Well, first off, counterintelligence assessments are highly sensitive because it is not really so much the target, Donald Trump, for example, that where we glean information. Counterintelligence means we are more interested in the spies or go-betweens or cutouts who are actually handling someone who we assess to be an asset. Good example is Maria Butina, young Russian person, claimed to be part of an organization called the Right to Bear Arms in Russia, in a country where you have no right to bear arms, who was sent to the United States to hang around in scantily clad pictures with her with guns, and infiltrated completely the NRA to the point where she had direct access to Donald Trump Jr., the highest levels of the NRA, and Donald Trump himself. In fact, was allowed to ask the first question at a conference in Las Vegas, where the first words she asked were, "What are you going to do about raising sanctions on Russia? Are we going to have good relationships with Russia?" She is an influence agent, and she had subsequently been arrested by the FBI in what they call a unregistered foreign agent. That is the term we use for spies. And, you know, she's, you know, this comely young woman who used her sexual capital to move around the NRA's, world and the Republican Party world, and got the NRA to be completely co-opted, not just by Putin, whom they loved. I mean, they loved him because they see him as a strong, European, Eastern European, bastion of Christendom, and the country that created the AK-47 assault rifle, so they love him, but many other components of Donald Trump's world has been rocked by these people also. But the FBI cannot and generally does not release the techniques that they have identified foreign spies and agents of influence to use, because they may be flooded with them. And so by releasing that, you sort of out how you're going to catch everybody else. And I'm not sure about the depth of reporting on that, but I wouldn't worry about an FBI report on Donald Trump. What I would worry about is, some of the things that we know about Donald Trump that I've written in my book. I mean, Luke Harding at The Guardian, Bild.de from Germany, and Czech 24 television in Prague, they released 10 years of surveillance reports on Donald Trump by the communists from 1977 to 1987 when he was married to Ivana Trump. I mean, the KGB has copies of everything, and they knew about Donald Trump wanting to run against George Herbert Walker Bush before anybody else did, because Trump's wife told her father, and they were monitoring all of their phone calls. So Donald Trump has been susceptible to foreign intelligence manipulation for a very, very long time. And, of course, Vladimir Putin, being a KGB spy master, would find it very simple to lead a person like Donald Trump around, on a dog leash, because Trump is in love with money, and he's more in love with Russian money than the Constitution of the United States or respect for the American flag.
Well, just in closing, Malcolm Nance, Ivana Trump, his first wife, whose father was an asset of the STB, the Czech intelligence, which reported to the KGB, she was Trump's...
actually the principal informant.
Right. Well, but Ivana was Trump's translator when he was given an all expenses paid trip to Moscow through Interest, which was a KGB front. He shows up in Moscow and Leningrad on July the 4th of 1987, and guess what the Russians are dangling in front of him? A Trump Tower. And that is where a lot of people believe he was essentially recruited, as what the KGB call a trusted contact.
Well, I think that Trump, I think that that might be overwrought. I mean, you're absolutely right about the history of all of that. And then, Trump Tower 1.0, Trump wasn't interested. But you have to understand, a rich, loudmouth, brash person who, millions in New York City, who had real money back then and was running, talking about entering the political scene, that person would be a useful idiot right out of the box. That's a term of art for the Soviets at the time, for the Russians at the time. Then, as you manipulate him further and enrich him in the post-Soviet era by buying houses and apartments and real estate and enriching him with dirty kleptocratic money that was stolen by liquidating the Soviet Union and, working with the mafia, then Trump becomes a unwitting asset. But by the time the 2016 election came around, he was well aware, and the Mueller report says he was aware these activities were going on and that they were designed to benefit him. And so he worked with his team to accept these benefits. That is a witting asset, not an agent. He hasn't signed a contract. He doesn't get tasking from the KGB, from the FSB, but he is a witting asset. And Vladimir Putin, former intelligence officer in the KGB, could easily lead this person around, because he's susceptible to blackmail, bribery, and all other nastiness that we're now seeing in the impeachment.
Well, Malcolm Nance, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure to have been here.
Well, thank you, Malcolm. And again, I've been speaking with Malcolm Nance, who's a career counterterrorism and intelligence officer with the United States Government Special Operations Homeland Security and Intelligence Agency. He has over 33 years of experience in combating radical extremism and is the author of The Plot to Hack America, How Putin, Cyber Spies, and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. And his latest book just out is The Plot to Betray America, How Team Trump Embraced Our Enemies, Compromised Our Security, and How We Can Fix It. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. But they take away my name. I got one hell of a job to perform for the U.S. of A. Got the responsibility of our nation's top security. But every night and day. Secret agent, man. This is the part. Oh, you got mags, that be dippy dippy dope, but the whole damn nation got the same. Honey, only fly to the bee, they're supporting not the president with government lane. Put me on a slow moving parliamentary hacking bandwagon, you could put me little ass in the grave. Every time you want it, I'll be live, bring a date. I mean, computer when it's over, press save. So, you can be the president. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Phil Sheenan, who's a best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, and a former reporter for The New York Times for more than 20 years. As a Washington correspondent for The New York Times, he covered the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the State Department. And as a foreign correspondent, he reported from more than 60 countries and several war zones. His latest book is A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. And he has an article at The Guardian, A Threat to Democracy, William Barr's Speech on Religious Freedom Alarms Liberal Catholics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Sheenan.
Ian, thank you.
And Phil, what did you make of the speech that was made on Friday night before the Federalists at the Mayflower Hotel? The Federal Society, of course, being the group that have essentially stacked the Supreme Court with very, very ultra-conservative Catholic justices. And they've also stacked the judiciary. Trump, needless to say, and it's an extraordinary thing, that Trump has seated more federal judges in, what, three-quarters of his first term than his three predecessors, Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, who served two terms. So there's no question that Trump is getting all these people on the courts, that the Federalists are essentially giving him the list. So this speech that took place on Friday night has alarmed many. What's your reaction to it, since you've also covered the earlier speech at Notre Dame, which was pretty alarming in itself?
I think there is a lot of alarm about what exactly Barr is up to, because, of course, when he came to the Justice Department earlier this year, he was seen as very much a sort of a mainstream figure, somebody who believed in a strong executive branch. But in statements recently and in these two speeches you've singled out, he seems to be taking extraordinarily extreme positions. And in the speech on Friday before the Federal Society, he seemed to suggest that, you know, a president could be all-powerful and that there should be very little oversight of the president, and that it was not the president who was shredding the norms and acting corruptly, but it was the people attacking him on Capitol Hill and elsewhere. And he seems to see the battles in Washington as very black and white, and he seems to see an executive branch under siege, when a lot of people in Washington, including many Republicans, see the actions of President Trump as those of shredding norms and acting corruptly.
Well, it's almost like he's in an alternative universe, William Barr, in a way that many of the House Republicans on the impeachment committee appear to be in an alternative universe in their arguments defending Donald Trump's handling of the Ukraine situation, which has led to an impeachment inquiry. In Barr's speech on Friday before the Federalists, he tried to make the case that this is a president who is being under relentless assault by the Democrats, and he can't get his nomination through, and that they are stymieing his executive authority. We have never had in this country a more activist president, somebody that acts on impulses and whims, who has no restraints on him whatsoever, who doesn't follow any advice from the state, defense, CIA, any cabinet member. And as I pointed out a minute ago, he has put more people on the court than anybody in such a short time. And it's just an absurd claim.
Well, I certainly think there are many sort of mainstream legal figures in Washington who would agree with you, both Republicans and Democrats. And people have been genuinely, as somebody who's been covering the Justice Department in Washington on and off for 20 years, I mean, people are really alarmed about what is William Barr's agenda here, because he seems to be defending often the indefensible, and he seems to be going out on a limb to defend President Trump from what seem to be very legitimate concerns that the president has violated the law and has shredded the norms that Bill Barr keeps focusing on. And one, I will say, there are certainly, you know, Catholics within the Justice Department who worry that that Barr is on some theological crusade, that he is defending through Donald Trump this very imperfect vessel. He's trying to impose on the United States some sort of vision of governance as seen within the Catholic Church a couple of generations ago.
Well, it's extraordinary, not just Barr's statement, but his association with Leonard Leo, who's a member of Opus Dei, and how many Opus Dei judges have not just been, they're actually on the Supreme Court. And it's hard to determine the exact number because Opus Dei is a secretive organization. But it looks as if there are at least four or five. And if you added the late Scalia to the list, you'd have six. And the extent to which there's an extraordinary thread here with so many of these people that have been converted by this Catholic priest who was basically run out of Washington. He was the head of Opus Dei in Washington until he had to be removed because of a sex scandal. And Opus Dei paid this woman who was molested by him or abused by him about $1 million. But prior to then, Father McCloskey had baptized former Kansas Senator Sam Brownback, GOP's Newt Gingrich, whose wife is now the ambassador to the Vatican. And then on top of that, of course, he also converted Larry Kudlow from Judaism when he was struggling with drug and alcohol addiction. Of course, Larry Kudlow being an economic advisor to President Trump, President Trump's own lawyer now, Pat Cipollone, he's also a member of Opus Dei. So I'm not trying to weave conspiracy theories here, Phil, but these just are the facts.
Well, I think we should be clear that Opus Dei is this very, very conservative Catholic organization that's known and has always been known for being very secretive. I don't think we know actually that some of these individuals are indeed members of Opus Dei, because the laymen and lay women who actually work for Opus Dei, they as a rule do not reveal that to the public. And I don't think we have any confirmation that Barr and some of these others are members of Opus Dei, but they are very closely associated with a group in Washington that is known to be Opus Dei. And William Barr and Pat Cipollone, who is now Donald Trump's White House counsel, and Leonard Leo, the head of the Federalist Society, or at least one of the senior executives there, they are all associated with Opus Dei through this group. And, you know, for very legitimate reasons, mainstream news organizations generally try to shy away from questions about a public official's faith. But it is interesting that around Donald Trump are a lot of very conservative Catholics, including some associated with Opus Dei, who seem to be defending Donald Trump, whatever the facts are. And they seem to be eager to defend Donald Trump, even though Donald Trump is no paragon of virtue for the Catholic Church.
And again, I'm speaking with Philip Sheenan, who's a best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, and a former reporter for The New York Times for more than 20 years. As a Washington correspondent for The New York Times, he covered the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the State Department. And as a foreign correspondent, he reported on more than 60 countries and several war zones. His latest book is A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. And he has an article at The Guardian, A Threat to Democracy, William Barr's Speech on Religious Freedom Alarms Liberal Catholics. And again, the priest who ran
Opus Dei's Capitol Hill office, which is quite near the Capitol, who Father McCloskey, I mentioned some of the people that he had personally baptized or recruited or whatever the word is, and we don't know exactly whether they've... It's not like, you know, are you a member of the Communist Party or something? I don't know that they have a bureaucracy where you become a card-carrying member, but I could add to the list Justice Robert Bork, who was up for the Supreme Court. But some of the stuff that McCloskey advocated, and he was very popular on television as an advocate for Opus Dei, he argued that American men suffered from friendship deficit syndrome and said that their wives should encourage their husbands to spend more time with their male friends and less time at home. And he said that a liberal Catholic is an oxymoron. The Catholic Church's teachings would call such a person a Protestant. So a lot of what was reflected in Friday's speech before the Federalists reflect that kind of conservatism, does it not? And the idea that Trump is beleaguered by the so-called resistance, what Barr specifically said in the speech on Friday, he said, "The fact of the matter is that in waging a scorched earth, no-holds-barred war of resistance against this administration, it is the left that is engaged in the systematic shredding of norms and undermining the rule of law." So I know that the conservatives, just as a matter of habit almost, try to build up the left as this powerful monolith, the liberal elite. They've turned them into an elite. You know, I'm broadcasting from Pacifica Radio that's teetering on bankruptcy. The left is not powerful in this country. It never has. It's been under attack forever, particularly during the McCarthy period, not to mention some of the right-wing Catholics involved in that. So what's going on here? The fact of the matter is that William Barr and his extreme conservative Catholicism is at odds with the Pope himself, who is very critical of the Trump administration and of programs like Muslim bans and the immigration policies that the Pope vociferously opposes, which William Barr defends.
I think that's absolutely true. I think in Barr's speech at Notre Dame last month, which was in many ways just as alarming as the speech he gave to the Federal Society on Friday, he was defending the views of right-wing Catholicism, but he failed to make notice of the fact that, you know, Pope Francis is very much opposed to much of what President Trump is doing, beginning with the Muslim ban and, of course, the entire attitude of the Trump administration towards immigration and refugees. You know, I think the Vatican has been very clear that it thinks that the Trump administration has been acting improperly in terms of dealing with refugees and immigrants.
So as a journalist, is there any way, Phil, to find out, to pin down this Opus Dei? When you are told from various articles that I've tried to read on understanding Opus Dei and its influence, particularly on the Supreme Court, you get lists. I mentioned Scalia being a member. It's also suggested that John Roberts might be a member because he's such a close friend of Leonard Lear, who recruits everybody and who's also a very close friend of William Barr's. And then, of course, Thomas and Alito, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh are also mentioned. I mean, do we have a right to know the religious and political ideology of our Supreme Court justices, particularly if they are a majority of them? I mean, in other words, Opus Dei is an extremely small, secretive sect in Catholicism. It doesn't represent the Catholic Church. So therefore, I think you have a legitimate question here. As you pointed out, journalism, editors, etc., they don't like to get into the religious stuff because it's very inflammatory and people are totally entitled to their religious beliefs. So it's not an area you should enter into clumsily. But the idea that 3, 4, 5 members of the Supreme Court out of 9 could be members or some way affiliated with an extremely conservative form of Catholicism does not reflect the broader United States. And that's where I have a problem.
Well, I say the only concern, and I think it's a legitimate one, is that unfortunately, you know, our country has a long history of prejudice towards Catholics. And news organizations, I think, are properly very skittish. But it does worry you know, I think it should worry us all, though, that there might be people within the government whose faith is causing them to want to break down the walls between church and state that have always been celebrated since the days of our founders. I think the concern about Barr's speech at Notre Dame last month is that he seems to be suggesting that we needed to break down that wall, and that, you know, what he referred to as Judeo-Christian ethics should really take be at the forefront of our thoughts in interpreting the law, when there are many people in this country, Muslims, Buddhists, and lots of others, who believe that this nation was born with a firm belief in that separation.
Well, but he reiterated these views. In fact, if anything, he doubled down in his speech on Friday before the Federalists in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely. I think people are very alarmed, and I think are legitimately worried about what is Barr's agenda, especially as we head into a year in which Donald Trump seems to be lashing out in all directions. And seems desperate to hold on to the White House for a second term. And is it possible that Barr is going to legally try to justify actions by the president that really should cause us great, great concern?
So do you think the problem is in terms of, you know, I mentioned the kind of spectrum of religion, which is tilted in our politics very much to the right? We have the religious right, the Protestant religious right, with the evangelicals. And you added to that William Barr and Leonard Leo, the Federalists, and the number of high-ranking people that are...
And we shouldn't forget Steve Bannon in all this as well.
Oh, of course. He
seems to be leading some sort of crusade to depose Pope Francis.
Which is very much the position that Opus Dei takes. I mean, they're opposed to almost everything he's doing. So... what's wrong with the religious left in this country? I mean, the Bible's on their side. Jesus didn't hate gays and carry an assault rifle and celebrate capital punishment and shake down poor people for money. I mean, what do you think that's the problem here, that the voice of the ultra-conservatives, whether they're Protestants or Catholics, dominate, whereas the moderate Catholics and or the bulk of the Catholic community, along with the Protestant community, just doesn't seem to step up and challenge these people who allegedly speak in the name of their religion? And on Friday, of course, Barr criticized radical secularists. I'm sure he considers me and you a radical secularist. I don't consider myself a secularist, but I'm curious about religion and interested in it, and I gravitate towards people of faith because they, by and large, are good people. But the idea that the religious left is not stepping up bothers me.
I think that's true. I mean, I think this is certainly a moment for people of faith who would be considered more centrist or more left-wing. This is their moment to step forward, because clearly the people in charge of our government, by and large, at least at the White House and in the federal court system, seem to be very much aligned with right-wing Christianity, when in fact there are many other points of view that are normally represented at the senior levels of government but aren't at the moment.
So do you think then that there will be a backlash to Barr, in the sense that the most alarming thing is what you pointed out, Phil Sheehan, is that he is aggressively tearing down the wall between church and state. And that is something that we've accused the religious right of doing. But this is a man with immense power. He's the one person that seems to be the most sensible person and the best tactician and strategist inside the White House. Now, there was apparently a screaming match a few days ago that was caught on camera, shooting through the window of the Oval Office, of Trump gesticulating wildly at William Barr. The assumption is that it might have something to do with Barr's refusal to have a public press conference and condemn the impeachment. But what can be done to remove Barr or to smoke him out as somebody that is an inherent conflict of interest?
Well, there are, just as a result of the speech on Friday, there are some prominent legal thinkers and scholars who suggested that Barr himself should be open to impeachment at this point. I think that's unlikely to happen in the next year. But probably, you know, in terms of restraining Barr, I think there's a possibility the Supreme Court will do that, that they, I believe there are Catholic members of the Supreme Court who don't hold such extreme views as William Barr and who may at the end of the day restrain Trump. Certainly they may, you know, allow his tax returns to be turned over to prosecutors. I think they may at the end of the day enforce or be asked to enforce the congressional subpoenas in the impeachment investigation. I think John Roberts he doesn't appear to be the same sort of rock-ribbed conservative William Barr is. But of course, the best way to restrain William Barr is for people to turn out next November and to vote President Trump out of office.
Well, Philip Sheenan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Philip Sheenan, who's a best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, and a former reporter for The New York Times for more than 20 years. As a Washington correspondent for The New York Times, he covered the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the State Department. And as a foreign correspondent, he reported from more than 60 countries and several war zones. His latest book is A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. And he has an article at The Guardian, A Threat to Democracy, William Barr's Speech on Religious Freedom Alarms Liberal Catholics.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
In Catholic school, as vicious as Roman rule, I got my knuckles bruised by a lady in black, and I held my tongue as she told me, son, fear is the heart of love. So I never went back. And if heaven and hell decide that they...
Top prime cut of meat, I'm your choice.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, David Redlawsk, who is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. He's currently a visiting professor at the University of Iowa and is the co-author of Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And his latest book is The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Redlawsk.
Thanks, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, David. And you're on your way to a meeting with the governor of Montana, Steve Bullock, who is...
I am, yeah. He's having a house party event in Des Moines, and I am on my way there to see what happens.
And he, of course, to my mind, is one of the most... promising candidates the Democrats could be fielding, but he's getting nowhere because of this crowded field that they have. I don't think these debates are helping winnow the field in any way. In fact, I think the debate on Wednesday, which of course will probably be overshadowed by the impeachment hearings, I think there's actually more people in it than were in the last one. So and yet, there you are in Iowa, where all of them show up. I guess if you wanted to get free potato chips and dip and lemonade, you could live off these house parties for, 3 months?
Yeah, you probably could. It is really interesting for the candidates who are not appearing on the debate stage or not showing up much in the polling as they continue to go around Iowa and in some cases New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. Bullock's a great example of this. He, you know, it's hard to see how he sees a path, given that nobody's paying any attention to him, and particularly the media's not paying any attention to him. At the same time, you know, he has at least a somewhat compelling story. He's won, you know, election to governor of Montana in a state that Trump won by 40 points, as Bullock notes all the time. But I think one of the things people need to recognize about Iowa is that, it gets everybody's hopes up, because you don't have to win Iowa. You have to surprise. You have to do better than expected. And I suppose if you're one of the also-runs, you know, at least you have a chance to do better than expected.
Well, the reason that, for example, the billionaire, former mayor of New York, Bloomberg, is entering the race is because they, and so with so Deval Patrick, former governor of Massachusetts, they're entering the race because of the perception amongst Democrats and I take it Democratic donors and the Democratic establishment is that there's nobody in the center anymore because Biden is tanking. But the center now it seems to be being filled by Pete Buttigieg, at least in Iowa, where he's surging in the polls and he's now ahead. So that's why I was interested in talking about Bullock, because I'd say I think he's probably the best centrist candidate they have. But he again, for reasons that mystify me, this process is not allowing the good ones to get any traction, whereas the others who have all kinds of weird motives and ego and money and all this other stuff and promoting their own cults, et cetera. It's just crazy.
Well, part of what's happened is the Democratic National Committee comes into this election deathly afraid of being accused of playing favorites because, of course, the last election when the Bernie Sanders people accused them of being of playing favorites. And so they've created a situation with the national debates where the barriers are, I think, really low, even though at this point, only 10 candidates will be on the debate stage. But they're low enough that it's keeping these, as you say, candidates with other intentions in the race as well. Steyer makes it to the debate stage, or Tulsi Gabbard at points, or, and in another world, the party would do more to clear the way, but it can't at this point. So the donors, particularly the centrist big money people, are really nervous. They're really nervous about Elizabeth Warren. They're really nervous about Pete Buttigieg. But there's reason to be nervous about Buttigieg, I think. He is doing well in Iowa. He has surged at the moment. We'll see if it's a bubble or if it's sustainable. But he's doing worse than horribly with non-white Democratic voters anywhere. And, that worries the centrist money people as well, not because they're necessarily in the same ideological space as those voters, but because those voters matter one hell of a lot come fall 2020.
Well, when you say, though, that Buttigieg is not in the center, I thought he was. I thought he was distinguishing himself particularly from Bernie and Elizabeth.
He is. But I think the money people worry about him for other reasons, not on the ideological basis. I think they worry about him partly because he's shown no ability to gain support outside, essentially, of a particular group of white Democratic voters. And I think secondly, because nobody really knows how the fact that he's gay and married and talks about it will play in November. And so, these folks who are in that position and worried about this, I forget ideology. They're conservative in the sense of not wanting things to be too weirdly different than they've ever been.
Well, I guess that would be, the idea that you think about the average American can accept a first husband in the White House.
Well, I don't know. Right. We've never actually asked the question directly. It's not really come up before in a serious candidate context. And, there's certainly reason to be nervous. I mean, one could make the argument that the people who would not accept it are highly likely not to vote for any Democrat. They're more likely to be conservative, perhaps Republican. know, there's strong support nationally for same-sex marriage these days. It's no longer really an issue from the standpoint of the national conversation. But at the same time, you know, again, if you look at Buttigieg's numbers outside of Iowa, look at South Carolina or Nevada, he's getting close to zero support among African-American or Latino voters. Is it because he's gay? I have absolutely no idea. But it's certainly true that at least some African-American voters are culturally conservative. Many Latino voters are Catholic and culturally conservative. But I don't want to overstate it, right? I have no evidence on this point at the moment.
Well, it does seem like Buttigieg is not doing well in South Carolina, and his campaign has stumbled there with the so-called Douglas plan. Sounds like bad staff work. But in general, he's doing incredibly well in Iowa, where he has a lot of big staff. And I expect he will win Iowa, and that will make him a front runner. That's how the system works, right?
I don't know. I will say we are still 10 weeks plus out from the Iowa caucuses. Iowans don't make up their minds. The data I have from the last couple cycles, the surveys tell us Iowans don't make up their minds until the last month. A good 60% of Iowans, Iowa caucus goers, decided on their candidate support in 2016 and in 2008 in the month before the caucus. So there's still a lot of fluidity. The Des Moines Register Iowa poll out last night that shows Buttigieg ahead also says that only 30% of their sample says that they're settled for sure on their candidate.
And again, I'm speaking with David Redlawsk, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware, who is currently a visiting professor at the University of Iowa. He's the co-author of Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process, and his latest book is The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning. So whether or not Buttigieg maintains his lead, and his lead in the poll now seems to be at the expense of Joe Biden, who's dropping, and Elizabeth Warren, who's also dropping a little less. My sense is, and you're there, which is why I'm calling you, David, is that isn't Iowa all about retail politics? I made the joke about the idea that you could live off these free chips and dips plates, tables at all these house parties, and you're off to a house party now. So, you know, I'm sure there'll be lots of potato salad and ham and whatever the local staple is in Iowa. Corn, I guess.
Corn.
And listening to the governor of Montana, who should be, I think, they're somebody that the Democrats should be taking seriously, but unfortunately they're not. So isn't it all about retail politics? That's the point I wanted to make. I think if you meet this guy, I haven't seen a lot of him on TV, but every time I've seen Pete Buttigieg, I'm absolutely floored by how articulate and intelligent he is, and how he speaks in very well-constructed and thoughtful sentences in ways that I've never, I mean, it couldn't be more opposite of Donald Trump, who just is absolutely, you know, a word salad of this guy really seems impressive. Is he impressive in person? Have you seen him in person?
I have seen him in person. I've seen him a number of times now. I go back to August when I saw him at in a relatively rural part of the state at an event where he was unveiling an agricultural plan. 300 people were there. That was pretty stunning to me because at that time he was polling at, you know, 3-4%, something like that. I mean, he just wasn't well known. But he was drawing the crowds well before he was reflecting it in the polls. I think partly curiosity. Iowans are going to a lot of events more than ever. They're considering a lot of candidates. But I think in going to a Buttigieg event, two things happen. One is the staff really is pretty good. He's got a good organization on the ground. Even back in August, they were grabbing folks and, you know, not literally, but making sure they were signed in and connected and that they knew who they were. And then, as you say, when you listen to him speak, he's dynamic, he's young, he comes across as smart. At the same time, I saw him just a few weeks ago in Des Moines, where he was beginning to take the pains he's now taking to position himself as the next coming of Obama. His introducer talked about how, you know, Iowa got Obama launched and how Buttigieg is another young new face who Iowa's going to launch. And I think that actually struck me a little oddly. But I think it's related as much to his need to reach out to non-white voters as it is anything. And I don't know if it works. That's, I think, the challenge. So with this poll that's just come out that puts him in the lead by 9 points over Warren and 10 over Biden, he'll likely have the target on his back Wednesday in the debate. We may get a sense of how he handles himself when he's the center of attention, and that should be really interesting.
So do you agree with me that but Biden appears to be fading? I don't know what explains Elizabeth Warren's dip in the polls. Bernie's actually going up in the polls in Iowa. And of course, Harris seems to have all but... She was putting all of her eggs in the Iowa basket, and that's got her nowhere. Yeah. How do you see this thing at least winnowing a bit? You know, I mean, that's my main complaint. I'm wrong. This is fine. You know, we've got plenty of time, but it just feels like the as I say, with particularly with the guy you're about to visit with, Steve Bullock. I just don't think some of the good guys who could get elected. Because at the end of the day, America is a conservative country, not a radical country, and that's what Barack Obama warned. They're the most electable, and the whole idea is to get elected, not to listen to great speeches.
Biden has certainly faded. I mean, some of it was inevitable because a lot of his front-runner status was name recognition and that sort of good feeling because he'd been the vice president, particularly here in Iowa. But he's not as active in Iowa. His campaign is not as visible as Warren's or Buttigieg. And I think that does matter. I'm certain the Biden folks see South Carolina as their firewall. He continues to lead strongly among African-American voters who make up a majority there. But, you know, when you think about winnowing, both Julian Castro and Kamala Harris are running on fumes. In many respects, they've both refocused supposedly on Iowa, although Castro then dissed Iowa. It's not clear to me, you know, they could be the next two major candidates who end up out. While, again, Tulsi Gabbard, Marion Williamson, Tom Steyer will just continue along anyway. I think it is a problem. But I do think it's a problem that will be solved as we get closer to the caucuses.
Well, David Redlawski, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with David Redlawski, who's a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware and currently a visiting professor at the University of Iowa. He is the co-author of Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And his latest book is The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side.